Good evening. I'm Amna Nawaz. Judy Woodruff is away. On the NewsHour tonight, the spread continues. Omicron appears in more states, even as health officials battle a surge of Delta COVID cases. Then, rising tensions. The United States declares a diplomatic boycott of the upcoming Winter Olympics in China, inflaming a fraught relationship. And Veterans Affairs. Secretary Dennis McDonough on meeting the needs of former service members, including those with toxic exposure and post-traumatic stress. All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. The United States will conduct a diplomatic boycott of the Winter Olympic Games in Beijing. The White House announced today that American officials will not attend the Games in February to protest human rights abuses in China. But American athletes are still free to compete.
I don't think that we felt it was the right step to penalize athletes who have been training, preparing for this moment, and we felt that we could send a clear message by not sending an official U.S. delegation.
Earlier, China warned that a boycott would trigger what it called, quote, firm countermeasures. U.S.-Russian tensions over Ukraine are still running high ahead of tomorrow's video call between President Biden and Russian President Vladimir Putin. Russian troops have massed along the Ukrainian border. Today, the State Department warned of severe economic consequences if the Russians invade. In Moscow, a Kremlin spokesman said that as things stand, bilateral relations with the U.S. are in, quote, quite a lamentable state. Three more members of a U.S. missionary group have been freed in Haiti after being held hostage since October. The group, based in Ohio, says the three were released on Sunday. A violent gang had abducted 17 people in all, 12 remain captives. The kidnappers have demanded $1 million ransom apiece, but it's unclear if anything has been paid. In Myanmar, a court today convicted Aung San Suu Kyi of incitement and violating COVID restrictions. She was given 2 years in prison. Suu Kyi had been this country's civilian leader before being ousted by the military in February. Today's ruling sparked new protests and a chorus of international criticism, including from the United Nations.
The military is attempting to use any means, including the judiciary, including the courts, to remove all political opposition. However, it's quite impressive that tonight in Myanmar, you are still seeing the banging of pots and pans by people in the country in opposition to the military.
Suu Kyi is 76 years old. She faces a number of other criminal charges with penalties totaling more than 100 years in prison. Back in this country, New York City ordered all private sector employers to require that workers get vaccinated. The mandate allows for religious and medical exemptions and takes effect on December 27th. It is the most sweeping move by any state or big city in the country. We'll return to the pandemic after the news summary. The U.S. Justice Department sued Texas today over its new congressional district maps. The suit says most of the state's population growth in the last decade came from minorities, but it says Republican state lawmakers crammed them into weirdly shaped districts to create safe seats for the GOP. Republican Devin Nunes of California will quit Congress within weeks to run former President Trump's new social media company. He informed constituents today that he's giving up his House seat. Nunes was first elected in 2002. He chaired the House Intelligence Committee and at one point accused the FBI of conspiring against Mr. Trump in the Russia investigation. Former Senate Majority Leader and Republican presidential candidate Bob Dole will lie in state at the U.S. Capitol on Thursday. That announcement today followed his death on Sunday at the age of 98. And on the Senate floor today, leaders from both parties paid tribute to Dole.
After his election to the Senate, Senator Dole quickly won the admiration of his colleagues with his candor, his sharp wit, his penchant for good-natured ribbing. But beneath all that was an unquenchable desire to get things done in this chamber.
With Bob Dole, what you saw was what you got. And from his comrades in the 10th Mountain Division to his constituents in Kansas to the whole Senate and the entire country, what we got was extraordinary.
We'll look back on Bob Dole's life and legacy later in the program. in Chicago today. Actor Jussie Smollett testified in his own defense, denying that he staged a hate crime on himself. He said, quote, there was no hoax. Two black men have testified that Smollett paid them to take part, but he said the money was for nutrition and training advice. Smollett says two white men beat him in January of 2019, shouting racist, anti-gay slurs, and pro-Trump slogans. A federal investigation of the lynching of Emmett Till is ending with no charges filed. News accounts today said the Justice Department informed the family. Till was lynched in Mississippi in 1955 when he was just 14 years old after a white woman claimed he whistled at her. No one was ever convicted of the murder. The case was reopened after a book quoted the woman as saying she had lied. The first black police chief in Minneapolis has announced he's retiring. Madaria Arredondo was promoted to the role in 2017. After police killed George Floyd in 2020, he fired the four officers involved. He's also faced rising crime and the loss of a number of officers. And Wall Street rallied today on hopes that COVID-19's latest variant may be less dangerous than first feared. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 647 points, nearly 2%, to close at 35,227. The NASDAQ rose 139 points, and the S&P 500 added 53. Still to come on the NewsHour, we examine the life and legacy of longtime U.S. Senator Bob Dole. Tamara Keith and Amy Walter break down the latest political news. The Pope condemns the treatment of migrants in Europe during a visit to Greece, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
For the first time in nearly 2 months, the United States is averaging more than 100,000 new coronavirus cases a day. This comes as roughly one-third of states have now detected the new variant, Omicron. John Yang has our report.
Omicron Delta continues to be the most dominant COVID variant, both in the United States and around the world. But with overall cases on the rise, questions abound about the Omicron variant. Caitlin Jedalina is an epidemiologist at the University of Texas Health Science Center's School of Public Health in Dallas, and she writes Your Local Epidemiologist on Substack. Caitlin Jedalina, thanks so much for joining us. First off, given what we know about Omicron, and maybe more importantly, what we don't know, how concerned should people be about it in America?
Yeah, you know, what we do know is concerning. But we also don't know a lot. And I think that there's a lot of hope that we don't want to lose at the same time. And so there's this balance between let's wait to see what the science is going to say and continue to be vigilant. Because like you said, our house is already on fire right now with Delta. And we really need to address that threat right now.
Today, Mayor Bill de Blasio in New York announced a vaccine mandate for private employers. What do you think of that step?
I think it's the right step. You know, vaccines do a lot. They reduce transmission. We have a lot of reason to believe that boosters will play a significant role against Omicron. But, you know, vaccines aren't going to do it all. It's not going to be, you know, the magic ticket. It's going to be a combination of public health mitigation measures, which includes rapid antigen testing, includes ventilating spaces, and includes wearing good masks indoors.
How likely, I mean, you know, we had this sort of concern when the Delta variant emerged, and now the Omicron variant is emerging. Are we going to continue to see this virus transmute itself, create different variants? And how should we be thinking about this? Or how should we be worrying about them as they arise?
Yeah, you know, you're right. This is going to continue to mutate. Viruses mutate. We expect this, especially with high transmission rates right now. The more opportunity we give this virus to jump from person to person, the more it is going to mutate and more it's going to change. I think what we need to understand is the direction that it's changing, as well as the severity and how well our vaccines continue to hold up against these changes. At the same time, have solutions in case they don't. For example, the vaccine manufacturers are on top of it, creating an Omicron-specific vaccine in the off chance that we do need it. And so really being a proactive game rather than reactive, and staying educated on how this is changing and why.
On your blog, you take a lot of questions from your readers. We've asked our viewers to submit some questions, and we want to put them to you. Dan Pat from Sarasota, Florida. I am fully vaccinated. Am I more, less, or the same at risk of getting COVID because of the Omicron variant? And if I do contract this variant, am I more, less, or the same risk of spreading the virus?
That's a really good question, and he's not going to like my answer because we don't know yet. You know, I think that if he is not fully if he's not boosted, he certainly should go get a booster. We have reason to believe that a booster will broaden the protection, not just against Delta, but also other variants of concern like Omicron. We think our hypothesis is that we're going to have a lot more breakthrough cases with Omicron, but we are optimistic that those with the boosted will have a less likelihood of severe disease and death. Like I said, we don't know the data yet. We should be expecting it to come within the next week or so.
And then we have from Kathy Webb in Ames, Iowa. We're, of course, approaching the holiday season when a lot of people are going to be traveling. She just simply asked, is it safe to travel?
Yeah, you know, if you're fully vaccinated, if you're boosted, if you wear a really good mask, and I'm talking N95s, you should be very confident in that, you know, protection bubble you have around you. Thankfully, also, airlines are still requiring masks. They are enforcing masks as well. So I'm really not concerned about the airplane specifically. I would be more worried about exposure getting to and from the airplane. And this is really where you need to distance yourself, continue to wear a mask, and remain vigilant. But then once you land, wherever you're going before your Christmas break, do rapid antigen tests. Use that as a quote-unquote day pass to make sure that everyone that's at that holiday family gathering is as safe as possible.
Along those same lines, Dr. Fauci said yesterday that they may lift the South Africa travel ban on visitors coming into the United States. And just today, the CDC stepped up its advisory against travel, Americans traveling to more places like France and Portugal. Overall, what do you think of these travel advisories and bans, both coming and going?
Yeah, you know, travel bans to a few select countries is not a public health evidence-based policy. It just doesn't work really well. It would work great if we shut down all borders, but we didn't do that, and we are a bit delayed. You know, Omicron right now is in 49 different countries. And so, you know, yeah, we may slow down spread, maybe seeds from South Africa, but that doesn't mean it's not coming other places. And so what that means to me is that our response on the ground in the United States really needs to be proactive with testing and vaccines.
Now from Michelle Joyce in Eugene, Oregon. She says, I'm a parent, and I'm very concerned to hear that there has been an increase in child hospitalizations in South Africa for children under 5. Is this variant more dangerous for kids?
Yeah, I'm a parent of 2 under 2 as well. And so I've been paying really close attention to this. And that is true. It looks like Omicron, kids with Omicron are going to the hospital at higher rates than with Delta. But it's really important to realize that we don't know why yet. But I think it's really important to keep in mind that what happens in one country doesn't necessarily happen in others. The landscapes are very different. Vaccination rates, behaviors, environments, genetics. And so we need to track the epidemiological data on the ground in the United States to ensure that this is a generalizable signal.
And from Caitlin Jeffers in Los Angeles, how likely is it for someone with natural antibodies post-COVID infection to be reinfected with the Omicron variant?
So this is actually the one piece of solid scientific data we've gotten so far with Omicron. It came out about 2 or 3 days ago, and it was not very great. It showed that a reinfection rate with Omicron is about 3 times higher than with Delta. And so, in other words, infection-induced immunity is not doing a great job at stopping Omicron. And this is really why the WHO, the CDC, and every epidemiologist I know is recommending vaccinations right now, especially boosters.
Caitlin Gentilina, your neighborhood epidemiologist, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
As we reported earlier, the Biden administration will not send an official delegation to the 2022 Beijing Winter Olympics. Administration officials say it's a move to protest China's human rights abuses. To break down what this means for U.S.-China relations, I'm joined by Victor Cha. He was the director of Asian Affairs on the National Security Council staff during the George W. Bush administration. He is now at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and a professor at Georgetown University. Victor Cha, welcome back to the NewsHour. Thanks for making the time. At this point in already tense U.S.-Chinese relations, what do you think a boycott like this, what do you think it's likely to accomplish?
Well, I think the accomplishment is to send a message to China, as they have already done, that the United States is not going to allow China to go unaccountable for the human rights abuses in Hong Kong or in Xinjiang or what they're doing to individual athletes. I don't think it's going to change Chinese policy. I don't think it's intended to change Chinese policy. But what it will do is the United States is leading and maybe other countries will follow. You know, it's a political boycott, which means it's not going to affect the athletes. And that's important because I think the athletes should be allowed to compete, unlike what happened in 1980 with the boycott of the Moscow Olympics by the Carter administration. But it's sending a very high-profile message that the United States is going to do something about the fact that China is sort of running rampant with regard to human rights abuses in its own territory and in other parts of the of its country.
Well, I guess it begs the question, could they have possibly sent a stronger message? Could they have called for a full boycott, as you mentioned they did in 1980, athletes also not participating, or coordinated with allies in advance so everyone could announce at the same time? Is this the strongest message they could send at this time?
I don't know. You know, there could have been a stronger message, but I think it's just about right, because to try to coordinate a broader response would have taken, one, it would have taken a lot of time. Two, it gives other countries and other leaders the opportunity to make their own choices rather than being cornered by the United States into making choices. And it's going to be difficult choices, clearly, for other countries as well. With regard to the athletes, I don't think this should affect the athletes. I mean, I think the athletes should go and they should compete and they should try to win. I mean, that's the most important thing. The biggest tragedy of the 1980 boycott was that it accomplished nothing in terms of changing Soviet behavior, and it ruined the lifelong ambitions of many athletes. So I don't think we want to repeat that. But I think it's sending the right message, and it gives other countries the opportunities to join or to opt out.
So China did warn of what they call firm countermeasures. What do you think those could look like? What form would they take?
It's hard to say. I mean, they could respond in a tit-for-tat fashion with some sort of political boycott of something involving the United States or something the United States hosts. They could respond with some sort of trade actions, which would be escalating the situation. You know, undeniably, the Chinese were going to be unhappy with this, and they will accuse the United States of mixing sports and politics when these two things should be separate. I mean, we expect that to come from the Chinese. But they're, I think, in the end, just going to grit their teeth. They know there's going to be a lot of criticism of them before the Olympics, and they're going to wait for the start of the Olympics, because once the games begin, everybody just focuses on the performances of the athletes. That's what happened in Beijing in 2008, and I think that's what they expect to happen this winter.
In the brief time we have left, I need to ask you, there was a high-profile case many of us have been following of the Chinese tennis star, Peng Shuai, obviously, who accused a former senior party official of sexual assault and then disappeared for weeks, reappearing seemingly under duress. The Women's Tennis Association suspended all tournament play in China in response to that and concerns over her well-being. Do you think that the U.S. government would have taken the action it did today without the WTA taking that step first?
I think they took that step in support of the WTA. You know, this is a big decision by the WTA. It'll cost them a lot of money, But it shows that China cannot simply use their economic potential or their economic market as a way to run roughshod over human rights. You know, the WTA showed they're not going to be in bed with the Chinese like the IOC have done, unfortunately, the International Olympic Committee and Thomas Bach. So in that sense, I think it's a sign of support for the WTA's actions.
That is Victor Cha from the Center for Strategic and International Studies joining us tonight. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
President Biden has vowed to improve veterans' access to health care, prevent veteran suicide, and specifically provide benefits to those exposed to toxic air while serving in the military. Nick Schifrin talks to the Veterans Affairs Secretary about those goals and how former service members have responded to the administration's efforts.
Last month, the White House announced a new model designed to provide benefits to more veterans who were exposed to toxic air. Many of these veterans lived and served next to so-called burn pits, where service members incinerated everything from tires to batteries. Veterans groups argued the pits created toxic smoke that afflicted service members with higher than average rates of asthma, bronchitis, even cancer. But many veterans' claims that their illnesses were caused by their service have been denied. The man tasked with changing that is Dennis McDonough, Secretary of the VA. Welcome to the NewsHour. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
I want to begin with some statistics that show the scope of the problem.
Yes.
Since the Gulf War in the early 90s, through this year, of 1.31 million veterans who filed a claim for a respiratory illness caused by their service, more than 40% of claims were denied. That's according to internal VA data that we obtained. From the Gulf War through this year, of more than 111,000 veterans who filed a claim for cancer caused by their service, more than 64% were denied. And according to VA testimony last year, VA has denied 78% of disability claims of toxic exposure from burn pits. Why so many denials?
Look, you know, I look at the 30 years a little differently. This president, President Biden, is the first president in those 30 years to presumptively link certain conditions and begin paying benefits and providing care based on those, that presumptive link, for veterans. Now, when you think about the number, we and the president announced in May that we'd cover three presumptions, conditions, asthma, sinusitis, and rhinitis. We anticipate 300,000 veterans will apply for those conditions. Already more than 7,000 have applied, and somewhere around 70% of those applications have been approved. I don't know if at the end of the day we'll be at full 70%, but the point is that it's long overdue that this gets done. This is the first president in 30 years to do it, and we're going to stay on top of it until, as your introduction suggested, this is fixed.
And to understand the problem, we have to diagnose it, though. If you could, why do you think this has been such a problem for so long?
Look, I think that people have been trying to establish a scientific connection to these exposures. And the level at which you establish that connection is really important. But we've made a determination based on the president's guidance that, as with everything else we do at VA, we should establish a threshold at which your condition should be considered caused by your service, provided that it's as likely to have been caused by your service as by anything else.
Your report for rare cancers is due in about 2 months or so to the White House. Then you'll consider a model for other illnesses, including constrictive bronchiolitis. How many veterans suffer from constrictive bronchiolitis, and how will they prove it, given that often it can only be diagnosed with a lung biopsy?
A lung biopsy itself is so invasive as to be dangerous to the health of the veteran. So we're coming up with new ways to do that. I don't know that they'll be ready then, but again, we want to establish the presumption if we can, and ideally we'll be able to do that without putting the veteran at further risk.
In speaking to veterans groups ahead of this interview, they say there's a perception born from the data that we looked at before that veterans assume their claim will be denied. How do you defeat that assumption?
Look, it breaks my heart. And part of the reason that I wanted to come talk to you is I know that a lot of our veterans watch this program, especially your all's reporting on this. And what I'd ask our veterans is, please come to us, file your claim. The act of filing your claim is important for your claim, but it's also important for your battle buddies, because we can use data analytics and data science to establish these connections in the hopes that we can continue to grant at the rate of 70%, which is what the experience since these three new presumptives for the first time in 30 years have been proceeding. I hope that continues.
Let's move to veteran suicide rates. 65,000 veterans since 2010 have died by suicide. That is 8 times the number of U.S. service members killed in Iraq, Afghanistan, and the war on terror. One of the focuses of the groups working on this is creating a physical distance between any veteran having suicidal ideation and a firearm, physical distance mm-hmm. between the firearm mm-hmm. and that person. How do you do that?
We're working through two very aggressive public campaigns. One that says, don't wait, reach out. Come to us, and we'll come up with a plan, even if you're not in a moment of crisis. The second one has to do expressly with firearm safety. And what we've said through a concerted public advertisement campaign on television, through social media, and then through earned media like this, is we've said that moment of suicidal ideation can be fleeting. As difficult as it is, it can be passing. And so we want at that moment for there to be some distance between the veteran and a firearm. So we have all sorts of established processes, including gun locks, that we have provided now almost 10,000 of them to veterans' families, so that they can safely store their weapons. This is a very simple step that we think that we can take.
Let's talk about your motto.
Yes.
Let's take a look at that right now. To care for him who have shall borne the battle and for his widow and his orphan. To care for him. There's a movement to convince you to change that, will
yes.
you?
It's not my motto. It's a quote that goes back to the second inaugural address for President Lincoln. We'll change the motto. How we do it and when we do it is going to be important. Most particularly the how we do it. We're talking to veterans now about what their expectations are. I'm not a veteran myself, okay? And I'm also not among the fastest growing cohort of veterans, women veterans. So we're talking to veterans, including women veterans, about their expectations. When that process is done, then we'll make some announcements.
But just to be clear, you are determined to change it so that it doesn't just
That's not that
him.
I'm determined to change it, it's that I will change it.
And finally, I want to show you a photo to end on. I want to show you Major Ian Fishback, retired veteran of Iraq and Afghanistan, blew the whistle on detainee abuse in Iraq. He struggled with mental health and eventually a court ordered him put on medication, placed in an adult foster care facility, and that is where he died in mid-November at the age of 42. His family was trying to get him help, including from the VA. What do you think his story says about how this country treats its veterans?
My heart breaks for Major Fishback and for his family. We became aware of the circumstance that Major Fishback was in. It was not what we call an enrolled veteran, but a lot of that stuff, you know, doesn't really matter at the end of the day. What I want is for all of our veterans and all the veterans' family members to know that we're here for them. So please let us know when you're in a time of crisis.
Do you think he fell through the cracks? Do you fear others are falling through the cracks?
I mean, we're working to get to the bottom of precisely what happened in the case of Major Fishback. As I've said, my heart breaks for him. I think the family is aware of how strongly we feel about this, how strongly I feel about this. Do I think other veterans have fell through the cracks? Until we're at zero veteran suicides, I will think that veterans are falling through the cracks. We owe them much better than that. And that's what we're going to do.
Dennis Fagnano, thank you very much.
Thanks, Nick.
We'll be right back.
As part of a multi-day trip to the Eastern Mediterranean, Pope Francis yesterday returned to the Greek island of Lesbos, a major hub for migrants, which he first visited 5 years ago. As Malcolm Brabant reports, the Pope sought to highlight the plight of asylum seekers and castigated Europe over its treatment of refugees.
Pope Francis returned to the frontline island of Lesbos at a time when Europe is doing its utmost to keep asylum seekers out. 6 years into the refugee crisis, European politicians' attitudes towards migrants range from indifference to outright hostility. Among world leaders, the Pope offers a rare compassionate voice.
I am here to see your faces and look into your eyes. Eyes full of fear and expectancy. Eyes that have seen violence and poverty. Eyes streaked by too many tears.
This footage from the Turkish Coast Guard is part of a growing body of evidence supporting accusations that for more than a year, Greece's centre-right government has been breaching international law at sea. The Turks, together with the UN's refugee agency and independent non-profits, allege that Greece is routinely pushing back migrants into Turkish territorial waters and putting them at risk. Pope Francis didn't directly address the issue of pushbacks, but his message was unmistakable.
It is easy to stir up public opinion by instilling fear of others. Let us not hastily turn away from the shocking pictures of their tiny bodies lying lifeless on the beaches.
Panayiotis Dimitras is a veteran human rights activist who is suing the Greek government over pushbacks.
What do you think of what the Pope had to say?
His speech was extremely strong and an implicit criticism, first of all, of the Greek government and also the European governments in general about the inhumane policies towards migrants, asylum seekers.
Some pro-refugee non-profits were disappointed that in his meeting with the Greek Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis, the Pope did not directly condemn the practice of pushbacks. Last month, at a joint press conference with the Dutch Premier Mark Rutte, Mitsotakis faced his most vehement criticism to date.
Prime Minister Mitsotakis, when at last will you stop lying? Lying about pushbacks, lying about what's happening with the refugees in Greece. Please don't insult mine and neither the intelligence of all the journalists in the world. There has been overwhelming evidence, and you keep denying and lying.
What I will not accept is that in this office you will insult me or the Greek people with accusations and expressions that are not supported by material facts when this country has been dealing with a migration crisis of unprecedented intensity, has been saving hundreds, if not thousands, people at sea.
Were you disappointed that the Pope didn't mention pushbacks, or wasn't it his place to do that?
It was his place, but he is a head of state. So he had to be diplomatic there to be able to focus or have people focus on all the things he said, as opposed to creating a backlash. How dare he mention something that the Greek government outrightly rejects?
Do you think the Greek government is going to take any notice of what he had to say, or is it just going to continue with its policy?
Well, listen, the Greek government is not taking notice of the European Parliament and the European Commission.
So it's doubtful the Pope persuaded Mitsotakis to soften his stance.
We are doing this every single day, rescuing people at sea, while at the same time, yes, we are intercepting boats that come from Turkey, as we have the right to do in accordance with European regulation, and waiting for the Turkish Coast Guard to come and pick them up to return them to Turkey. So rather than putting the blame on Greece, you should put the blame on those who have been instrumentalizing migration systematically.
While the Pope may have been diplomatic, analysts assure that images like these help to shape his speech.
The Mediterranean, which for millennia has brought different peoples and distant lands together, is now becoming a grim cemetery without tombstones. This great basin of water, the cradle of so many civilizations, now looks like a mirror of death.
The Pope's words may not move Europe's politicians, but they stirred Tango Mukaya from the Democratic Republic of Congo.
I'd like to thank you for the solidarity and the humanity that you showed to us, your children, migrants, refugees, who are in Lesbos, in Greece, and elsewhere in the whole world. May God acknowledge your actions.
No sooner had the Pope left Lesbos than the regional governor said he hoped the papal visit would not lead to a new influx of migrants. The reality here is that there is no political appetite for making life any easier for asylum seekers for fear of encouraging more. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Malcolm Brabant.
Now we take a look back at the decades-long career of Bob Dole, who helped shape the Republican Party as a senator from Kansas, majority leader, and presidential nominee. Judy Woodruff has this report on his lifetime in politics.
Bob Dole's storied political career spanned five decades and took him from the heights of power in Congress to the lows of failed presidential bids. He mused on it all in a NewsHour interview in October 2014.
I don't know what my legacy will be, that I live to be 200 or at least 100, and that I never forgot where I was from.
Robert Joseph Dole was born in the small town of Russell, Kansas in 1923. He grew up with a brother and two sisters in the hard times of the Great Depression. His father ran an egg and cream stand, and his mother sold Singer sewing machines to help make ends meet. Dole went off to college, but World War II intervened. He enlisted in 1942 and was sent to Italy in 1944.
The infantry moves toward the jump-off position.
In April 1945, weeks before the war ended, Dole was trying to rescue a radio man when he was hit by enemy fire. It shattered his right shoulder, fractured vertebrae, and for a time paralyzed him from the neck down. He spent 39 months recovering, mostly in military hospitals, where he listened to Frank Sinatra's You'll Never Walk Alone every day for inspiration.
When you walk through a storm.
His brother, Kenny, interviewed years later, reflected on just how bad Dole's injuries were.
I never was so shocked in my life to see him as he laid there in bed from where I saw him last. You know, it's like yesterday and today. It's just a whole new ballgame. And it, at that time, the doctor said he couldn't live another 48 hours.
Eventually, Dole returned home to Russell to continue recovering with the support of family. And when he was fully recuperated, he finished college and law school and went on to serve as a county attorney and in the Kansas State Legislature. In 1960, he ran for the U.S. House of Representatives, pulling out all the stops to boost his name recognition. There was a singing group called Dolls for Dole. Dole pineapple juice was a staple at campaign stops, and his 7-year-old daughter wore a skirt that read, "I'm for Daddy, are you?" It all worked, and Dole won. 8 years later, in 1968, he won a seat in the United States Senate. There, he became known for a moderate to conservative voting record and an ability to bridge policy divides.
Often when we ran into problems of one senator against another or one group against another on some issue, Bob would figure out a way to untangle it.
Former Democratic Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell worked closely with Dole after the Kansas Republican became Minority Leader.
We had a lot of trust with each other. I never once doubted his word. He never once doubted mine, and we became close friends, even as we competed vigorously. It doesn't have to be personal. You can compete on the issues. Sometimes he prevailed, sometimes I prevailed. That's democracy. And he was a great practitioner of democracy.
But Dole was also a partisan warrior. He served as Republican national chairman starting in 1972 and defended President Nixon during much of the Watergate period. He impressed Nixon's successor, President Gerald Ford, who asked him to be his running mate in 1976. The announcement came in Dole's hometown.
It shows that you can come from a small town in America, but you don't need the wealth and all the material things in this world to succeed, if I've succeeded, and some might quarrel with that.
Don't be fooled by the words.
But Dole also earned a reputation for a sharp tongue. And during a vice presidential debate with Walter Mondale, it came back to haunt him.
I figured up the other day, if we added up the killed and wounded in Democrat wars in this century, it'd be about 1.6 million Americans, enough to fill the city of Detroit.
I think Senator Dole has richly earned his reputation as a hatchet man tonight by implying and stating that World War II and the Korean War were Democratic wars.
The Ford Dole ticket lost. But in 1980, Dole ran for the Republican presidential nomination, again returning to Russell for the campaign's launch.
Whenever I set out on a new path, I've come back here to begin. No failure has ever been so hurtful that this place could not ease the pain. And no success has ever been so great that its satisfaction exceeded the satisfaction of being a part of the people of Russell.
Good to see you.
Still, Dole struggled to gain traction and dropped out after a poor showing in the New Hampshire primary. 8 years later, after President Reagan's two terms, he tried again for the White House, discussing the decision with Jim Lehrer.
Don't you have to want it very badly to go through what you and the others go through to be a candidate?
I think you have to have the drive, but you shouldn't be driven. I mean, you shouldn't be so obsessed with becoming president or anything else, whatever you may do, that you sort of lose your perspective. And I mean, a lot of people maybe be consumed by ambition. I just have to have it. It's the next step. It's power. That would be for all the wrong reasons.
Dole lost the 1988 nomination to Vice President George Bush, but he had one more presidential race in him in 1996. He resigned from the Senate, where he had become majority leader.
And I agree with the prairie poet Carl Sandburg, who told us, yesterday is a wind gone down, a sun dropped in the west. I tell you that there's nothing in the world, only an ocean of tomorrows, a sky of tomorrows. And like everybody here, I'm an optimist. I believe our best tomorrows are yet to be lived.
This time, Dole became the oldest first-time presidential nominee at the age of 73, only to be overwhelmed by President Clinton's re-election landslide. Even so, his work was far from over. He championed construction of the World War II Memorial on the National Mall and routinely met with veterans in Washington. Along the way, he helped his second wife, Elizabeth, in her own Senate career. And through it all, he said, there was always time for going back to Kansas.
So I've had a great experience because the people of Kansas and both parties have supported me, and so I don't think my legacy will be the people of Kansas.
As the country looks back on the legacy of Bob Dole, many politicians are also looking ahead to next year's elections, including an especially contentious race in Georgia that's already heating up. Our Politics Monday team is here with me to analyze it all. That's Amy Walter of the Cook Political Report with Amy Walter and Tamara Keith of NPR.
And welcome to you both. Always good to see you. I want to take a minute and just talk a little bit more about Bob Dole. Decades of public service, right? A lifetime of service there. It's worth noting the party changed a lot over his lifetime. And we actually found a clip back from 2016 when he was the only former Republican presidential nominee to endorse then-candidate Donald Trump. And Lisa Desjardins actually spoke to him on the convention floor. Here's what he had to say about that.
I like Donald Trump because he's a strong leader. And he is someone who can work with Congress. If you can't work with Congress, you can't get anything done.
Tam, Dole stood apart from other Republican leadership in making that statement. What do we know about why?
You know, he was a partisan political figure. He as Senate Majority Leader and Minority Leader, was very much a Republican fighter. But at the same time, he also had significant bipartisan accomplishments, including getting the Americans with Disabilities Act through. And he had friendships with none other than people like Joe Biden, who visited him at home after he got his lung cancer diagnosis this year, which points to a different era of politics when people could both do battle and be friends, and when doing things on a bipartisan basis wasn't necessarily seen as, you know, a betrayal of the party.
Yeah, that's right. Also important to note that he most recently had said, I also supported Donald Trump in 2020, but he lost. Mm-hmm. It's over. There was no voter fraud, right? So making the claim that, look, idea that Donald Trump lost the election because it was stolen, not true.
It was a different era of politics.
Yes.
It was a different Republican Party. You look at that party today, we often end up reporting on stories that this is a party where, you know, members of Congress have openly used bigotry against other members of Congress. One, you know, saw Lauren Boebert from Colorado saying Islamophobic things about Ilhan Omar. We saw Paul Gosar sharing a violent video. Is all of this also kind of part of the political legacy here of Bob Dole?
Well, you know, what's interesting about the era that Bob Dole was in Congress, there were also most members who had served in the military. 75% of the members of Congress in the early 70s had some level of military service. And I think there was something really important about that era because they could, as Tam said, fight on the floor, fight over issues, even get into, you know, pretty acerbic back and forth with one another, but they fundamentally understood they were on the same team. I might have a blue jersey, you may have a red jersey. And probably one of the most powerful moments I remember of Bob Dole's life, especially his later life, was when Dan Inouye, senator from Hawaii, very liberal Democrat from Hawaii, also served in World War II, mm-hmm. also was grievously injured. They shared a really special bond, and Bob Dole was in his wheelchair. It was hard for him to get to the service. In the rotunda where Dan Inouye was lying in repose, and he did everything he could to stand up and salute him. That could change if, mm-hmm. right, we get back to this idea that we're all serving together as Americans, not one party or the other. One interesting statistic, even though the number of veterans in Congress has dropped a lot, it's now only 17%, the number of people under 45 who have served in the military, mm-hmm. who serve in Congress, is about a third. So if theoretically we can get those folks, those younger folks who've served in the military, to get into leadership positions, that may be one way to sort of break some of the dysfunction in Congress.
Let's look ahead, not that far ahead, actually, but to the 2022 elections. All eyes were already on the Georgia governor race, right? Stacey Abrams announced she will run again. More interesting today, the race became more interesting, rather, because former Republican Senator David Perdue announced he is now jumping in. He's going to be primarying the current Republican governor, Brian Kemp. I just want to play a quick clip from both of their announcements.
Opportunity and success in Georgia shouldn't be determined by your zip code, background, or access to power. But if our Georgia is going to move to its next and greatest chapter, we're going to need leadership.
I'm running for governor to make sure Stacey Abrams is never governor of Georgia. Make no mistake, Abrams will smile, lie, and cheat to transform Georgia into her radical vision of a state that would look more like California or New York.
Tam, those battle lines are very clearly drawn already. What are you watching in that race?
Well, first, there's going to be a primary, and that primary is going to be messy. I don't see a way that this Republican primary doesn't get very ugly very fast, because current governor Brian Kemp is persona non grata to former President Donald Trump, because he refused to do what Donald Trump wanted him to do to overturn the results of the election. And because he wouldn't get involved, he wouldn't call a special session of the legislature, Donald Trump has been actively bashing him and at the same time raising concerns like, oh no, Stacey Abrams could win. Well, now there is a Trump ally who, as part of his video, in addition to these things he said about Abrams, he said a lot of things that weren't necessarily true, blaming Kemp for his loss in that Senate race. A lot of Republicans in Georgia actually think that the former president and his unwillingness to accept the election results, saying everything was rigged, made people not really that excited about voting again in January in that special election, in January.
Well, and Stacey Abrams only lost by, 50,000 votes in 2018? Does she have a better chance now?
She has a political environment that's much tougher, so the headwinds are much stronger now than they were back in 2018 when she had much more of a tailwind. But the thing helping her is this, a big fight on the Republican side. They're going to spend a lot of money. They're going to, as Tam pointed out, it could be very bruising. That certainly is very helpful to her. And let's remember, this is not the first race where Donald Trump has waded in against a sitting incumbent governor, which you usually don't see former presidents doing or sitting presidents do. In Massachusetts, his decision to endorse a challenger to very popular Republican governor, Charlie Baker in Massachusetts, is essentially what got him out of running for re-election. And that's an opportunity, a missed opportunity for Republicans as well, because Democrats now favored to win that governorship.
That is going to be one to watch. Before we go, Tam, I have to ask you about a new analysis from your colleagues at NPR. Looks at COVID deaths, takes a deep dive into county deaths, found people in pro-Trump counties, those went heavily for President Trump in 2020, nearly three times as likely to die from COVID. We kind of had a sense of this, but these numbers are really alarming.
Yeah, there's a very strong correlation there. It also correlates to the share of people who believe disinformation about the COVID vaccines. It also correlates to less fear about COVID. So you combine less fear of COVID with believing all kinds of wild, untrue things, fewer people getting vaccinated, lower vaccination rates in these counties. Lower vaccination is directly connected to more people dying because the vaccines save lives. They prevent disease from being as severe and prevent people from hospitalization and death. And they protect people, and people, Republicans in these pro-Trump counties are less likely to be vaccinated. It is stunning. It is depressing. I asked the White House about it today, and what they said is, you know, they've tried a lot of things, they've tried a lot of persuasion, but one of the reasons that they have now pushed forward with these controversial vaccine mandates is because the only way to get some people to get vaccinated will be to require it, as unpopular as it is with the very same population that we're talking about.
And we see the Biden White House very much still working to try to get those unvaccinated people their shots. Tamara Keith, Amy Walter, that's Politics Monday. Always good to see you both. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And online right now, part of a panel discussion led by our own Nicole Ellis on the barriers people face after prison. Advocate Jay Jordan shares how his decades-old criminal record still bars him from parts of life many take for granted, like coaching his son's baseball team. You can see that on our Instagram feed or watch the full conversation on our website. That's pbs.org/newshour. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Amna Nawaz. Please join us online or again here tomorrow evening. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you for joining us. Please stay safe. We'll see you soon.